Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoeAndReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CoeAndReview.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 15th of March, 2024, from the news section. First Minister's Questions. Humza Yousaf says, no complacency on drug deaths. This article is written by Steph Braun. First Minister Humza Yousaf has insisted there is no complacency from the Scottish Government on the deep-rooted problem of rising drug deaths. Douglas Ross and Anas Sawa both attacked Yousaf at FMQs after figures published by Police Scotland suggested suspected drug deaths increased by 10% in 2023 in Scotland, with 1,197 recorded. Greater Glasgow saw the highest number with 303, followed by Lanarkshire, which had 147, and Edinburgh City with 118. Ross said the situation was Scotland's national shame, while criticising a defence from Drugs Minister Christina McKelvey that the government's plan is working. Meanwhile, Sawa accused the government of incompetence, pointing out Scotland has three times the number of drug deaths than anywhere else in the UK. Yousaf said he was devastated by the rise, particularly as there was evidence of progress the year before, with a reduction in suspected deaths. He said, we are taking a range of significant actions to try to tackle this insidious problem in our society. We have an unwavering, unshakable commitment to the national mission to tackle drug deaths, and that's why we've continued to expand residential rehab. We've provided £50 million a year to community and grassroots organisations that are helping those in their local areas with substance abuse and addiction. We've progressed work with local authorities like Glasgow on safer consumption rooms. We've continued to roll out the carriage of naloxone. This rise is deeply disheartening, but what it will only serve to do from a government point of view is ensure that we continue to rededicate ourselves to tackling one of the most insidious challenges we face in our society. There is absolutely no complacency about the action we have to take. Ross suggested Yousaf had allowed the vital Turning Point 218 service, a rehab service for women, to close in Glasgow. But Yousaf insisted this was a Glasgow City Council decision, adding there remained a whole range of facilities for women facing substance abuse in the city. Yousaf also denied his government are cutting beds, as suggested by Ross, as he said his government invested £38 million for expanding capacity in residential rehab. He added 32 of these beds are operational, with another 38 in the pipeline. Yousaf said, we are willing to work cross-party in order to resolve one of the most difficult challenges this country faces. Sawa pointed out 5,200 had died since the Scottish Government declared a drugs death emergency 4 years ago, but Yousaf insisted that he and McKelvey had directly fronted up to those figures. The First Minister further insisted government action meant there was now better access to treatment and the introduction of naloxone kits have been vital to saving lives. He added the kits have been used more than 500 times since being introduced. Elsewhere at FMQs, SNP MSP John Mason was taken to task by the First Minister when he tried to claim legalisation to implement anti-protest buffer zones around abortion service was overreaction. Mason claimed women going for abortions were not being intimidated or harassed by people holding protests and prayer vigils. Youssef advised his colleague to listen to women affected by the protests who have given powerful testimonies and evidence about how they have been impacted. He said, "I think what's so important in this, particularly for men, is to listen to the voices of women, and women tell us and have given powerful evidence and testimony that whatever John Mason's views may be, they feel harm is being done. They do feel harassed and they do feel intimidation. Even if John Mason was to discard that evidence, and I would urge him not to, he should also listen to the clinicians at the services, the likes of Dr. Greg Irwin and others, who have spoken very powerfully about the impact it's also having on staff." That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday, the 15th of March, 2024, from the comments section. "If we must pay for the royals, the least they can do is be honest." This article is written by Emma Guinness. The latest scandal to hit the royal family has once again brought home the need for Scottish independence. While most of the country grapples with the rising cost of living, our money shouldn't be spent on a publicly funded rich family who can't even provide the original version of a photograph they've admitted was doctored. Unlike celebrities, the royal family's entire continued existence depends on the relationship they have with the people who they supposedly rule, and, like any relationship, it is built on trust. This trust has been rocked more than ever by the first official picture released of Kate Middleton since Christmas Day, a Mother's Day greeting, full of editing abnormalities, including unusually shaped limbs and, whether deliberate or not, the absence of a wedding ring. This went far from unnoticed by online commentators who have been asking, "Where's Kate?" following the Princess of Wales's total absence from public life after planned abdominal surgery in January. While it was said that she would not return to public duties until after Easter, the public were told she was making good progress after the surgery. But the princess has not been reliably photographed at all since then, prompting a wave of speculation that she is either sicker than previously revealed, potentially in the midst of a divorce from the future king, Prince William, or even hiding because she's undergone a Brazilian butt lift. In an unusual move, Kensington Palace did confirm that the Mother's Day greeting had been altered the day after it was pulled from circulation by international news agencies over concerns about its authenticity. But when the palace was asked to provide the unedited photograph to prove this, they refused. This admission of deception, followed by the failure to provide reasonable evidence of the truthful photograph, is fundamentally unacceptable. The royal family are in receipt of around £86.3 million a year from the taxpayer, via the sovereign grant. This is enough money to significantly help the estimated 4.2 million children currently living in poverty in the UK. It also only fuelled the rumour mill about Kate's potential whereabouts. Surely if the firm had nothing to hide, they would have released a photograph and the public would have been glad to see the princess well with her children. The fact that they have not suggests that all is not well with the Waleses and further damages the institution which has been struggling to win the public over again after Prince Andrew's allegations of sexual misconduct, and that's not to mention the allegations of racism made by Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. It also further cements the us-versus-them mentality that isolates the royals from the general public, who ultimately have a right to honesty from a family whose existence they fund. The royal family are not celebrities, but they seem to want celebrity status and respect for privacy, while living off money that's a birthright at a time when millions of people in the UK are suffering. I was personally floored to discover that Buckingham Palace was liable to pay a mere £1,828 in council tax, which is marginally more than what most people in the UK, myself included, pay for a one-bedroom flat. That's not to mention the estimated £8 million that's being spent on hanging new portraits of King Charles in public buildings, something that feels like an exercise in vanity when Victorian diseases like rickets and scurvy are on the rise because people are struggling so much. We are living in the year 2024. There is no need for a king to lead an army or a head of state to provide hope, the way a young Queen Elizabeth did after the Second World War. Unlike the royals, who have millions anyway, what the UK and Scotland need is money. And, quite frankly, if they are hiding a major secret about Kate Middleton, this should be the end of them. But if it's not, Scotland needs to get out of this union if we are to have any chance of flourishing the way that we know we can independently. After all, we don't even benefit from the tourism the royals bring to England, and at this stage they are nothing more than a failing tourist attraction. It's time for a divorce, even if the Waleses remain together. That article was written by Emma Guinness. This is from The National on Friday the 15th of March 2024, from the news section. Michael Matheson breached MSP Code of Conduct in iPad Bill Row. This article is written by Steph Braun. Former Health Secretary Michael Matheson has been ruled to have breached the MSP's Code of Conduct following a probe into the near £11,000 bill he racked up on a parliamentary iPad. Matheson stepped down from his cabinet post last month, citing an ongoing parliamentary investigation as the reason. The Scottish Parliamentary Corporate Body, SPCB, published its findings on Thursday, but said its full report would be released after consideration by Holyrood's Standards Committee. The SPCB decided that, based on the evidence presented in the investigation report and its findings, in fact, Mr. Matheson had breached sections 7.3 and 7.4 of the Code of Conduct, and thereby upheld the three complaints within the SPCB's remit, the body said. While the cost to the public purse had been addressed, the SPCB agreed that the Nolan principles of standards in public life embedded in the scheme and underpinning the appropriate use of parliamentary resources represented the high standard by which all members must abide and in which the SPCB considered the public must continue to have confidence. The report will be referred to the Standards, Procedures and Public Appointments Committee to consider if the former minister should be sanctioned. Matheson racked up the bill while on holiday in Morocco. He had initially agreed to claim £3,000 of the bill as part of his expenses allowance, while his office provision paid the rest, meaning the public purse covered the bill in full. He later agreed to cover the cost himself and admitted the fees were the result of his teenage sons using his parliamentary iPad as a hotspot to watch football. When he resigned from his ministerial post, he said, "It is in the best interest of myself and the government for me to now step down to ensure this does not become a distraction to taking forward the government's agenda." That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 15th of March 2024, from the news section. Scottish businesses urged to support the National's Gaza fundraiser. This article is written by Steph Braun. Scottish businesses are being called upon to support the National's fundraiser for Palestine. Gordon McIntyre Kemp, CEO of Business for Scotland, has urged businesses to donate what they can to help those suffering in Gaza, something he insists would be humanistic, not political. The National is raising funds for medical aid for Palestinians, and despite setting an initial goal of £15,000, the amount raised has now risen to more than £95,000. The aim is now to raise £100,000 by Saturday, March the 16th. The money raised will help get more urgently needed medical aid into Gaza and distribute it to those in need. We have outlined how important medical aid for Palestinians' work is, as people in Gaza are literally starving. McIntyre Kemp has specifically called on Scottish business community to show support for the fundraiser. He said, "Man's inhumanity to man continues unabated. Maybe we can do nothing about that. Maybe it's too big an issue to address, but we should not feel hopeless or become detached from the tragedy in Palestine, because we can all help, even if it's just a small contribution to the humanitarian effort. Regardless of your political or religious beliefs, or your thoughts on the historical roots of this conflict, the horror and suffering of people, young and old, should prove unacceptable to anyone who has even a modicum of care and kindness for their fellow human beings. Millions of innocent civilians are caught in the crossfire in Gaza. Supporting medical aid, which will save the lives of the civilian victims of this carnage, is humanistic, not political." Scottish writer Val McDermid has backed the campaign, stressing that even a small amount helps. Hollywood actor Alan Cumming has also shown his support, sharing the National's campaign on his Instagram story on Wednesday. That article was written by Steph Braun.
This is from The National on Monday, 18th of March, 2024, from the News section. DWP error leaves thousands owed £6,250 in back payments. By Joshua Searle. Thousands of people are being told they could be due a share of £500 million following a Department for Work and Pensions error. The DWP owes £500 million in back pay to more than 80,000 people across the UK, including married women, widows and pensioners. Each person who's been affected by the error could be due a back payment of £6,250 on average. A review by the DWP found there had been a possible 82,323 underpayments, mostly involving married women who reached state pension age before April 2016. The government department plans to give an update on how much of the money has been paid back to those owed by the end of March. Some groups of people who may be included in those who have received underpayments are people over 80 who were already getting a pension when they turned 80 who should have had their pension increased, married women who are supposed to get more pension when their husbands retired, widows and widowers who should have gotten a better pension after their partner passed away. Pensions Minister Paul Maynard said, "The department uses all available resources to identify heirs. In the instance when a response is not received for the initial contact letter, we issue further letters inviting the heir to contact DWP. Pensioners will see their state pension increase by up to £900 next month as an announcement made at last year's autumn statement comes into effect." Chancellor Jeremy Hunt confirmed that the triple lock on pensions would be honoured, with state pensions set to rise from April 1st. Under the triple lock, which guarantees an increase in line with average earnings, inflation or 2.5%, whichever is highest, pensions will increase by 8.5% next month. Opening last year's autumn statement, Hunt said, "After a global pandemic and energy crisis, we have taken difficult decisions to put our economy back on track. We have supported families with rising bills, cut borrowing and halved inflation. Rather than a recession, the economy has grown. Rather than falling as predicted, real incomes have risen. Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done." The Chancellor went on to announce plans to honour the triple lock on pensions in line with an increase in wages. He told MPs, "The triple lock has helped lift 250,000 older people out of poverty since its inception in 2011. It's been a lifeline for many during times of inflation. We honour our commitment to the triple lock in full. We will increase the new state pension by 8.5%, worth up to £900 more a year." That article was by Joshua Searle. This is from The National on Monday, 18th of March, 2024. From the News section. Edinburgh Airport proposal could see US border staff introduced. By Joe Sullivan. Edinburgh's airport could soon see American border control agents taking up posts. Several Irish and Canadian cities have pre-clearance facilities on site, which allow passengers travelling to the US to go through customs and immigration before boarding the plane. Airport CEO Gordon Dewar said he hopes to make Edinburgh the next on the list, telling The Independent he is trying to rally the US and UK governments to support the changes to make the great opportunity a reality. He told the paper, "For a long time, we've understood the value of pre-clearance. We see the benefits when we look at Dublin Airport and others, and we've been constantly growing our direct American connectivity over the previous years. So we know it's a great opportunity." Pre-clearance allows passengers to leave the airport immediately after disembarking from their planes, avoiding travelling through customs and immigration after a long-haul flight. This could lead travellers from across Europe to book transfers through Edinburgh, looking to save time and avoid stress on their flight to the US. It also means passengers can book easy connections through American airports from Edinburgh, which would let them avoid the hassle of rechecking bags and going through security. Edinburgh has more connections to the US than any other airport in Scotland, with direct flights to New York, Chicago, Washington DC, Boston and Atlanta. But just over the Irish Sea, Dublin Airport has a much wider range of links. Dewar said, "If you look at what Dublin has achieved, they've got a similar size of population to Scotland and Ireland, and yet they've probably got about four times as much connectivity to the States. A big part of that is the pre-clearance offer. Building a pre-clearance facility would likely give Edinburgh Airport a competitive advantage over other UK airports. Pre-cleared flights departing from the city could use domestic gates at American airports, letting airlines avoid the logistical and financial struggle for the scarce supply of international slots available. Customs pre-clearance already exists in the UK, but it's limited to rail travel to France through the Channel Tunnel. Launching the scheme would require the signing of an agreement between the US and UK governments." Dewar estimates it would take 2 to 3 years after the signing of an agreement for pre-clearance facilities to be created. That article was by Joe Sullivan. This is from The National on Monday, 18th of March, 2024, from the Politics section. GB News. What Ofcom rules did shows hosted by Tory MPs breach? By Adam Robertson. Ofcom has found that 5 episodes of GB News presented by Tory MPs have been found to breach broadcasting rules. The watchdog had announced investigations had been opened into particular episodes of a number of shows last year. It has since found that 2 episodes of Jacob Rees-Mogg's State of the Nation, 2 episodes of Friday Morning with Esther and Phil, and 1 episode of Saturday Morning with Esther and Phil, broadcast during May and June 2023, broke broadcasting rules. What rules were broken? Ofcom says it found that the shows failed to comply with rules 5.1 and 5.3 of the Broadcasting Code. It notes that these are the first breaches of these specific rules recorded against GB News and said that the channel has been put on notice and that any further breaches could result in sanctions. We told at the beginning of the month that Ofcom published a ruling on Lawrence Fox's tirade against a female journalist on the channel and that concerns had been raised about the channel's live output. What does the code say? Section 5 of the Ofcom code relates to due impartiality and due accuracy. Specifically, here's what rules 5.1 and 5.3 say. News, in whatever form, must be reported with due accuracy and presented with due impartiality. No politician may be used as a newsreader, interviewer, or reporter in any news programme unless, exceptionally, it is editorially justified. In that case, the political allegiance of the person must be clear to the audience. Following the investigation, Ofcom said, "We found that 2 episodes of Jacob Rees-Mogg's State of the Nation, 2 episodes of Friday Morning with Esther and Phil, and 1 episode of Saturday Morning with Esther and Phil, broadcast during May and June 2023, failed to comply with rules 5.1 and 5.3 of the Broadcasting Code. We found that host politicians acted as newsreaders, news interviewers or news reporters in sequences which clearly constituted news, including reporting breaking news events without exceptional justification. News was therefore not presented with due impartiality." It went on, "Politicians have an inherently partial role in society, and news content presented by them is likely to be viewed by audiences in light of that perceived bias. In our view, the use of politicians to present the news risks undermining the integrity and credibility of regulated broadcast news." That article was by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Monday, 18th of March, 2024, from the News section. Scottish firefighters to donate fire engine to Gaza, by James Walker. Scottish firefighters are donating a surplus fire engine to their counterparts in Gaza to help save lives amid the ongoing war. The appliance will be fitted with the latest equipment and donated to the Palestinian Fire and Rescue Service by the Fire Brigades Union later this year. It will be the third fire appliance donated since 2011 by the FBU, which has long provided support to the Palestinian Fire Service through exchange visits, training, and the provision of breathing apparatus, firefighting kit, and equipment. The appliance, which will travel to Gaza later this year, has been donated by the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service. Jim Malone, a former firefighter and an FBU official, said, "The situation in Gaza is appalling. The people are being subjected to unimaginable horrors on a daily basis. There is an urgent need for supplies to alleviate the humanitarian crisis that has unfolded. Our comrades in the Palestinian Fire and Rescue Service battle every hour to save lives as the Israeli government continues its collective punishment of the civilian population. Whilst carrying out their duties, they have come under sustained attacks from Israeli forces. We hope that the delivery of this fire appliance later this year will help protect the lives of innocent men, women and children. But our greatest hope is for a permanent peace and justice for the people of Palestine. Plans about how the fire appliance will travel to Gaza are still being made. The Gaza Health Ministry said at least 31,645 Palestinians have been killed in the war, which was sparked by the October 7th Hamas attack on southern Israel that killed 1,200 people and saw militants seize about 250 hostages. That article was by James Walker.
From The National, Monday the 18th of March, from the comments section, "Our great single parents deserve more recognition and better support." Article by Satwat Rehman, CEO, One Parent Families Scotland. Single parent families make a quarter of all families in Scotland. It is a little known fact that, among the many weird and wonderful awareness days, there is one dedicated to single parents. Single Parents Day, which falls on Thursday, is a day to pay tribute to the strength and love offered by so many single parents to their children, and to acknowledge just how tough, yet rewarding, being a single parent can be. It is always a positive and celebratory day, with online and in-person events being organised across Scotland by OPFS and by our partner, Fife Gingerbread, Parenting Northern Ireland, Gingerbread England and Wales, and One Family Ireland. This year's theme is recognition, which values single parents' role as sole carers and providers for their children, as well as recognising the need for wider support and structural change, which addresses the inequality and poverty single parent families experience. This year, we are dedicating a full week to spotlighting the financial inequality faced by single parents, the need for childcare, and the importance of good mental health and well-being, community and connection. In Scotland, 90% of single parents are women, and gender inequality is a significant cause of the barriers facing many single parents. By having to combine the role of sole carer and provider for their children, and being unable to pool resources with another adult, single parents and their children are more likely to be in poverty than any other type of household, 38% compared to 24% of all children. Most single mothers are in work, and almost half are working part-time, but there is a limited number of job opportunities that fit around caring responsibilities, which should provide a viable route out of poverty. Single parents have been disproportionately impacted by cuts to the UK's social security system, from the benefit cap to the two-child limit, to the young parent penalty, which scrapped a previous policy of paying parents under 25 the adult rate of benefits. Stricter work requirements recently introduced by the UK government now require single parents in receipt of universal credit to work up to 30 hours once their child turns 3. This is despite single mothers facing multiple barriers when looking for work or to increase their hours, the biggest of which is access to affordable and flexible childcare. Our research shows that 1 in 5 single parents was unable to afford childcare, and a Scottish Government survey found that single parents were twice as likely as couple households to have difficulties covering the cost of childcare. Investing in childcare is essential to lifting children out of poverty. Only when the childcare services meet their needs will single parents have equal opportunities to enter and progress in employment. caring for children is vital for a successful economy. Many single parents, especially those caring for disabled children, work in the care sector, receiving low wages due to the undervaluation of care work. OPFS is proud to be part of a coalition of almost 50 organisations that wants to see care given its rightful recognition, an issue we are highlighting as part of Single Parents Week. A new national outcome on valuing and investing in care, and all those who provide it, would commit the Scottish Government to placing care at the very heart of Scotland's future economy. A recent survey on single parent discrimination by campaigners Single Parents Rights revealed that many single parents feel invisible due to a lack of understanding of their needs. Changing societal attitudes towards single parent families requires not only cultural shifts, but also policy changes that value and support single parents and their children reaching their full potential. During this year's Single Parent Week, we want to show that there is a community and support out there. Isolation is one of the hardest aspects of being a single parent. We want to challenge stereotypes and send a clear message that people in Scotland and around the UK stand in support of the many single parents out there who are doing a fantastic job raising their kids. And that was a comment piece by Satwat Rayman, CEO, One Parent Families Scotland. For more information on One Parent Families Scotland and open days and events during Single Parents Week 2024, see opfs.org.uk.
The National, recorded on Tuesday, 19th of March 2024. The Culture Section. Exclusive, Jim Reid of the Jesus and Mary Chain on Touring, Sobriety and Scotland, by Adam Davidson. While making the latest The Jesus and Mary Chain album, Glasgow Eyes, frontman Jim Reid spent a lot of time thinking about the what-ifs or what-could-have-beens as he reflected in the significant moments that shaped the band in his life. One moment in particular that stuck with Reid was the infamous performance at the House of Blues in Los Angeles in 1998, which is the focus of a new song, Jam Cod. The gig ended after just 15 minutes when Jim and his brother William brawled on stage as they wanted to kill each other. Following the fight, the future of the band looked doomed as the pair went their separate ways, not reuniting until 2007. Reid said that in hindsight, the Jesus and Mary Chain probably didn't need to break up for as long as they did. What happened was complicated, but for one reason or another, William and I had veered off in different directions, he says. Creatively, not so much, but in every other aspect of our lives, and we just argued about everything. If we'd taken a year away from the band and not seen each other for that time, we would have realised that it was worth saving. But we were in this mad situation where it was obviously going to explode at any second. Reid believes that management, or someone close to the band, should have stepped in and advised them to take a little break. Instead, they booked the brothers for a three-month tour across the US. Just at a time when we wanted to kill each other, we found ourselves in a tour bus, which is one of the most claustrophobic environments you can imagine, Reid said. It was about 12 other guys and two brothers who at the time couldn't stand the sight of each other. That was never going to end well. The band achieved a breakthrough success with the critically acclaimed 1985 album Psycho Candy, which was recorded in London. However, the foundations of the band were very much formed in East Kilbride. Despite having lived in England for so long, Reid still feels an incredible sense of homecoming when he comes back to perform in Scotland. He said, "It's always good going back to Scotland. It sometimes takes moving away from a place to realise what was great about it. One thing he believes makes Scotland special is the people and their sensible outlook in life. They're less hysterical than the English," he says. For instance, Scottish people did not vote for Brexit and English people did. Politically speaking, there's a lot of knee-jerk reactions in English politics that you don't get so much in Scotland. The band are set to play an intimate warm-up gig at St Luke's in Glasgow tomorrow, ahead of their UK/EU 40 years tour, before returning for a show at Edinburgh's Usher Hall in March 27. Reid said the 1998 breakup helped increase their popularity and anticipation for tours and performances when they eventually reunited. "When we broke up in 1998, we were an annoyance to people. It was like, fuck, are they still here?" Reid says. "We broke up for 9 years and we seemed to become legendary during that time. There was a much more reverential treatment of the Mary Chain when we came back." Live shows aren't always something that Reid looked forward to. In fact, when the band was first formed, neither brother wanted to be the frontman, so they decided to flip a coin on who would take on that role. "I'm incredibly shy and William is not much better. We wanted to be in a band, but the idea of standing in the middle singing was utterly fucking terrifying," Reid says. "I didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it.
So we tossed a coin and I lost. I struggled with it for a long time. I feel quite comfortable with it now, but for years and years I couldn't do a gig sober. From the first period of the band up until the breakup in 1998, I never did a gig sober, not one. I was either on drugs or drunk out of my mind. At the time of the 2007 reunion, Reid had been sober for about 3 years and would be performing without drink or drugs for the first time, which was a daunting prospect. It was terrifying. I'm back in the band and all of a sudden I'm playing Coachella in front of God knows how many people and I'm doing a duet with Scarlett Johansson. I'm like, get me a fucking funnel and a bottle of whiskey now. Reid came to the realisation that people have much harder jobs than performing, so he took a leap of faith. It was a transformative moment as he realised he didn't have to depend on drink and drugs to become relaxed on stage. I don't always feel like I need to be drunk now. I do fall off the wagon from time to time. I did at the end of the last year. Reid says, I was on the bottle again when I was working on this record, but I'm sober now. It's just the way it works. I tend to get sober for about 5 years and then something happens. Glasgow Eyes is out on Friday. It can be ordered at themarychain.com, where tour details are also listed. By Adam Davidson. The National, recorded on Tuesday, 19th of March 2024. The Culture Section. Scottish Museum named as country's most popular attraction. By Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. The National Museum of Scotland has continued to be Scotland's most popular tourist attraction, with 2.2 million visitors last year. The Edinburgh site, which houses everything from scientific artefacts to natural specimens, saw off competition from the likes of Edinburgh Castle and Glasgow's Burrell Collection to boost its footfall by more than 200,000 compared to 2022. Elsewhere, historic venues maintained by the National Trust for Scotland, NTS, saw visitor numbers exceed pre-pandemic levels as 4.3 million people toured its heritage properties, up from 4.1 million in 2019. The most popular historic venue was the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum in Ayrshire, where a new collection of previously unseen artefacts went on display in January 2023. Visitor numbers topped 200,000, an increase of 13% on the previous year. The NTS also saw a surge in interest for the House of Dun in Angus, a grand 18th century home in Parkland which drew more than 44,000 visitors in 2023. Work was completed in July 2021 to transform the historic stable block area into an exhibition celebrating the rural heritage of Angus, and visitors can now get guided tours led by experts in costume. Meanwhile, a project to restore the interior decoration at Alexander Greet Thompson's Homewood House in Glasgow has been credited with boosting visitor numbers by 40% year on year. The House of the Bins near Linlithgow reopened in March 2023 after a programme of restoration and redecoration has helped to nearly double its visitor numbers since its last season in 2018. Chief Executive of NTS Scotland Phil Long said, "For 2023, we've exceeded our visitor targets for the year and our pre-pandemic levels too, with 4.3 million visitors coming to experience our special places all across the country. It's especially pleasing to see that our programme of projects is making a difference too, encouraging more people to visit and ensuring that they have a more memorable time when they do. In 2024, we're looking forward to sharing the new properties which joined our charity last year, the Treshnish Isles and the Macintosh at the Willow, which show the amazing variety of places in our care and ways people can enjoy and experience Scotland's nature, beauty and heritage." The news comes as figures from the Association of Leading Visitor Attractions, ALVA, shows that overall numbers to tourist attractions across the UK remain lower than they were pre-COVID. The trade body, which monitors over 2,200 tourist sites including museums, galleries, palaces, castles, cathedrals, zoos, historic houses, heritage sites, gardens and leisure attractions, said many people remain out of the habit of going to them due to closures during the pandemic. ALVA director Bernard Donoghue said, "Attractions are recovering well, but suggested the cost of living crisis is having an impact, with many visitors making tactical judgments about how they spend their leisure pounds." By Adam Robertson.
The National News on Wednesday, the 20th of March. Almost a third of pupils miss school regularly, report says. An article written by Jane McLeod. Education Secretary Jenny Gilruth has branded the number of pupils missing school as not acceptable, as new figures showed a drop in attendance rates. She hit out after statistics showed that in 2022-2023, almost a third of pupils were classed as being persistent absentees, meaning that they had missed 10% or more of all sessions. The figures published by the Scottish Government also showed that the overall school attendance rate fell to 90.2% in 2022-2023, down from 92% in 2020-2021. The report revealed that while attendance rates had increased to 93.7% in 2014-2015, there had been consecutive decreases since then. The largest drop was from 92% in 2020-2021 to 90.2% in 2022-2023, it said. Ms. Gilruth said the rates of persistent absence highlighted in these figures are not acceptable. "I'm absolutely clear that there must be a renewed drive across all levels of government and agencies to address this as a priority." Ms. Gilruth has now told Scotland's Chief Inspector for Education to ensure that persistent absence is addressed at every school inspection, along with identifying successful methods of tackling the problem so that these can be shared more widely. The Education Secretary also said she would, this week, bring together members of the Scottish Advisory Group on Relationships and Behaviour, which includes local authority leaders, council education directors, Education Scotland and others, to focus on persistent school absence. It comes as the latest figures revealed schools had an increase in both authorised and unauthorised absences. Sickness was the most common reason for authorised absences, while truanting was the biggest reason for pupils having unauthorised absences. However, the report added that the biggest contributor to the increase in unauthorised absence from 2020-2021 to 2022-2023 was unauthorised holidays, with more parents opting to take their children away during term time. Pupils in the poorest parts of Scotland had a lower attendance rate than those youngsters in the most affluent communities, the report revealed, with an attendance rate of 86.8% in the most deprived parts of Scotland, compared with 93.5% in the least deprived areas. Ms. Gilruth said that as a first priority, the Scottish Government was working with councils to return attendance to pre-COVID levels and to reduce persistent absence as far as possible. But Scottish Tory education spokesperson Liam Kerr said, "These highly concerning statistics expose how many pupils have been abandoned on the SNP's watch." He insisted the number of children who were persistently absent was deeply alarming. An article written by Jane McLeod. The National News on Wednesday, the 20th of March. Climate watchdog says that Scotland's 2030 goals now beyond what is credible. An article written by Ross Hunter. The UK's independent climate change watchdog has said the level of emissions reductions needed for Scotland to reach its 2030 targets is now beyond what is credible to achieve. A new report from the Climate Change Committee said that for Scotland to achieve the goal of cutting harmful emissions by 75% by then, the rate of emissions reduction in most sectors would need to increase by a factor of 9 in the years up to the end of the decade. As a result, it said the acceleration required in emissions reduction to meet the 2030 target is now beyond what is credible. The Scottish Government is failing to achieve Scotland's ambitious climate goals. It noted that annual targets for reducing emissions had repeatedly been missed, with a rise in emissions in 2021 linked to colder than average weather that year and an increase in transport emissions post-COVID, the eighth time in 12 years that targets had not been achieved. The committee also noted the publication of Scotland's new draft climate change plan, which was due late in 2023, had been delayed. As such, it said there was no comprehensive delivery strategy for meeting future emissions targets. Calling on ministers to publish this urgently, the committee insisted that actions continue to fall far short of what is legally required. The Climate Change Committee's 2023 report to the Scottish Parliament did note some positive developments, such as progress in delivering renewable electricity generation in Scotland. The country is on track to meet its offshore wind capacity targets by 2030, although it is slightly off track for this year's target for onshore wind. It also noted the positive progression of the Acorn Carbon Capture and Storage Project in Aberdeenshire, which was officially selected for UK government funding in 2023 after years of uncertainty from Westminster. Furthermore, the report notes that the attempt by the Scottish Government to roll out a deposit return scheme, which was delayed until at least 2025 due to the UK Government's refusal to fully exclude it from the Internal Market Act. Still, as it stands, the committee said that the current overall policies and plans in Scotland fall far short of what is needed to achieve the legal targets under the Scottish Climate Change Act. It went on to state that most key indicators of delivery progress are off track, with the report adding this was significantly so for tree planting and peatland restoration rates, heat pump installations, electric van sales and recycling rates. It said, by the end of this decade, Scotland will need to treble the pace of rollout of public electric vehicle charge points, reduce car traffic by 20%, increase heat pump installation rates by a factor of at least 13, and double onshore wind capacity. Woodland creation will need to more than double by the mid-2020s, and peatland restoration rates need to increase significantly. Looking at transport, the Climate Change Committee said sales of electric cars and vans were lower than in the UK as a whole, with only 2% of new vans sold in 2022 being electric models. While there is an ambitious target to reduce the number of kilometres driven by motorists by 20% of 2019 levels by 2030, the committee added a clear strategy on how this will be achieved is still missing. Professor Piers Forster, interim chairman of the Climate Change Committee, said, "Scotland has laudable ambitions to decarbonise, but it isn't enough to set a target. The government must act. Scotland's climate change plan needs to be published urgently so that we can assess it. We need to see actions that will deliver on its future targets." Environmental campaigners also demanded action from ministers, with Friends of the Earth Scotland head of campaigns Imogen Dow saying, "The chickens have come home to roost for a Scottish government that has repeatedly failed to implement the changes needed since the introduction of the climate targets over a decade ago. This is an embarrassing and abject failure of politicians to deliver on their legal commitments to the Scottish people." The Scottish Government was contacted for comment. An article written by Ross Hunter. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 20th of March. Ian Livingstone defends the probe into SNP finances almost a year on from the arrests. An article written by Adam Robertson. Police Scotland's former Chief Constable has defended the long-running investigation into SNP finances. Ian Livingstone has spoken to this week's Herald on Sunday, almost a year on from when the inquiry escalated, with the search of the home of former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon and her husband Peter Murrell. So far, both Ms Sturgeon and Mr Murrell, as well as former SNP Treasurer Colin Beattie, have all been arrested and released without charge. The operation was first launched in July 2021. Mr Livingstone left Police Scotland last August and is now leading Operation Kenevo, a long-running investigation relating to the Troubles in Northern Ireland. He was pressed on concerns the ongoing investigation is damaging the SNP in the run-up to the next general election. "We have always acted in the interests of justice and the rule of law. The political circumstances are around us at all times," he said. "I know we've acted with due process, but I've been retired a matter of months now, and the matter of branch form is no longer a matter for me." He was further pressed on whether or not a £110,000 campervan at the centre of the investigation should be returned. The vehicle was towed away by the force last year from outside Ms Sturgeon's mother-in-law's house in Dunfermline. Asked if this should be returned, he said, "I don't think anything should be happening until there is a decision from the Crown Office." Last week, SNP Westminster leader Stephen Flynn joked that the campervan could be given to the Tartan Army for Euro 2024 in Germany. He also said he still believed comments he made last year when he said, "The sooner Operation Branch Form is over, the better for everyone. I said the sooner things come to a head for everyone, the better it is, and I still believe that," he said. Mr. Livingston also said he would not give advice to his successor, Joe Farrell, saying it would be inappropriate to do so, but that he wanted both her and the force to do really well. He also rejected criticisms, including from the SNP's chief executive Murray Foote, that the operation had been heavy-handed in the search of Miss Sturgeon's and Mr. Murrell's home, including the erection of an evidence tent outside the couple's home. He said, "I think it was proportionate and necessary, as I said at the time, and I still believe I would have been in neglect of duty had we not acted as we did." A Police Scotland spokesperson told the Herald, "As the investigation remains ongoing, we are unable to comment." It's understood that the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service has not received a standard prosecution report on Operation Branch Form. A spokesperson for the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service said, "Senior professional prosecutors from the service and an advocate depute are working with police on this ongoing investigation. It's standard practice that any case regarding politicians is dealt with by prosecutors without the involvement of law officers. All Scotland's prosecutors act independently of political interference. As is routine, to protect the integrity of ongoing investigations, we do not comment in detail on their conduct." An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 20th of March. New images show the deterioration of a Trident sub. An exclusive article written by Xander Elliots. The UK government has been urged to come clean on the state of the nuclear infrastructure at Faslane after new images of a submarine returning from patrol showed obvious rust and missing panelling. The Vanguard-class submarine, one of four which are supposed to patrol the oceans, carrying the UK's nuclear weapon deterrent at all times, was photographed by locals near Helensburgh as it returned from a patrol mission which lasted in excess of 6 months. Patrols have grown longer and longer in recent years in order to cover for the fact that two of the UK's four Vanguard-class nuclear submarines are currently in maintenance, and three of them should already have been retired. The submarines each had a 25-year lifespan, limited by the lifespan of major components, and either commenced sea trials or saw their reactors go critical in 1992, 1994, 1996 and 1999. The images of the Vanguard-class submarine returning to Faslane last weekend show the anti-sonar anechoic tiling which lines the craft's exterior was missing in parts, with large sections of rust also visible. Last year, reports which the Royal Navy have not denied said that one submarine nearly met with disaster due to a broken depth gauge. The problem meant that the crew was continuing to descend without knowing that they were approaching crushed depth, the point at which the pressure on the submarine could cause it to implode. And last month, it was reported that the test firing of a Trident missile from one of the Vanguard-class submarines had failed for the second time in a row. Martin Doherty-Hughes, the SNP's defence spokesperson at Westminster, said, "We in the SNP have a long-held opposition to weapons of mass destruction. In addition, we also regard the extended missions of the UK continuous at-sea deterrent a risk not only to members of the Royal Navy, but critically to the people of Scotland. The well-known failures in the nuclear deterrent infrastructure should concern not only those of us opposed to nuclear weapons, but anyone who supports them. It's time for the Ministry of Defence to come clean on these failures." David Cullen, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information Service Research Organisation, said, "This is the second consecutive patrol lasting more than 6 months, and the latest in a succession of long patrols. Even supporters of the UK's nuclear weapons have expressed concerns about the impact on crews from these patrols, which are the result of reliability problems and the increasing maintenance requirements of the Vanguard fleet. Alongside the massive cost rises we're seeing in the nuclear weapon upgrade projects, the Ministry of Defence is clearly struggling to maintain their nuclear posture." Earlier this year, concerns were raised about the state of the UK's nuclear infrastructure by Dominic Cummings, the former chief advisor to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Mr. Cummings said that in 2022, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak had approached him for help with the next general election campaign, and he had asked for several conditions in return. One of these, he said, was addressing the fundamentally critical issue of the scandal of nuclear weapons infrastructure, which is a dangerous disaster and a budget nightmare of hard-to-believe and highly classified proportions. Lynn Jameson, the chair of the Scottish Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, said, "The reality is that Britain has never been able to afford the nuclear weapons system the UK government clinged to as an act of irrational faith. The long duration of submarine patrols, the increased incidence of accidents and incidents, and the obvious physical deterioration of vessels all indicate the perilous state of the British nuclear weapons system that is hosted in Scotland." Scottish Green MSP Ross Greer added, "Repeated serious safety concerns have been raised, and the number of alarming incidents continues to rise. But even putting those very important issues to one side, there is simply no moral case for nuclear weapons. They are a grotesque and deadly Cold War relic and have no place in Scotland." A Royal Navy spokesperson said, "Our continuous at-sea deterrent protects us and our NATO allies every moment of every day. We are immensely grateful to the submariners on board and their loved ones for their commitment and dedication. While we do not comment on patrol lengths, we take safety very seriously, and all submarines go through rigorous safety checks before any patrol." An exclusive article written by Xander Eliads. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 20th of March. First Minister and Nicola Sturgeon pay tribute to Mark Drakeford. An article written by Adam Robertson. Hamza Youssef and Nicola Sturgeon paid tribute to Mark Drakeford as he prepared to officially step down as First Minister of Wales. He tendered his resignation to the King yesterday afternoon after taking a final round of questions from opposition leaders. Mr. Drakeford's successor, Vaughan Gething, will take over today and will become the first black man to hold the role. Writing on X, formerly known as Twitter, Mr. Drakeford said it had been an honour and a privilege to hold the role and thanked everyone for their support. Responding, former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said, "Mark has been an outstanding First Minister of Wales. Principled, thoughtful, hard-working, he always stood up for Wales and for those in society who most need government on their side. He will be the hardest of acts to follow. I will always be grateful for his counsel and friendship while I was First Minister, particularly as we negotiated the toughest of times during COVID. I wish him all the very best for the future." Mr. Youssef wrote, "My very best wishes to Mark Drakeford, a model public servant who has rightly earned the respect of colleagues across the political spectrum. Mark has been a strong defender of devolution and has always been a friend of Scotland. I wish him all the very best for the future." After his last First Minister's questions, Mr. Drakeford was banged out by members from across the chamber. The outgoing First Minister has been in post since 2018, when he took over from Carwyn Jones. Mr. Drakeford announced his intention to stand down late last year. He dealt with personal tragedy last year when his wife of 46 years, Claire, died suddenly, aged 71. Mr. Drakeford said his advice for his successor was to be ready for any question, saying he treated it like preparing for finals. The 69-year-old described Mr. Gething, who is 50, as a careful and considered person and said he looked forward to supporting him from the backbenches. An article written by Adam Robertson. The National. On Wednesday, the 20th of March. Opinion. Why the media is complicit in extreme narrative around Hamza Youssef. A column written by Caitlin Logan. According to Godwin's Law, as any discussion on the internet goes on, the likelihood of someone being compared to the Nazis or Hitler increases. But when is a comparison to Nazi Germany appropriate to make? Not when referring to the Tories' dehumanising language about asylum seekers in Britain today, as Gary Lineker discovered last year. Aside from his brief suspension by the BBC from presenting Match of the Day as a result of his comments, which ended after many of his colleagues chose to boycott the programme in solidarity, Mr. Lineker was accused by none other than former Home Secretary Suella Braverman of diminishing the unspeakable tragedy of the Holocaust. Certainly not when comparing the actions of the Israeli government in Gaza, Even descriptions of the ongoing atrocities in Palestine as a genocide have been routinely denounced as offensive and anti-Semitic. MP Kate Osama can attest to this, as she has now been suspended for nearly 2 months from the Labour Party for listing Gaza amongst the genocides which should be remembered on Holocaust Memorial Day. But if you're talking about the First Minister and leader of the SNP's wish for the Tories to lose their seats in the upcoming general election, well, an outright comparison to the Nazis is perfectly acceptable. At least, that's the impression one could come to from BBC Radio Scotland's decision to air a text from a listener who reacted to Humza Yousaf's stated aim to use this election to make Scotland Tory-free by describing this as Humza's final solution for dealing with a Tory problem. This, of course, is a reference to the chilling euphemism used by Nazi Germany's leaders, who said the Holocaust was their final solution to the Jewish question. The comment, read out by BBC presenter Kay Adams, characterised Mr Yousaf's comments as slowly getting rid of all political opposition. This is the rhetoric of the 1930s, and asked whether Scots who voted Conservative are to be banned from expressing their opinion. There are so many levels on which this is offensive that it's hard to know where to start. What is most concerning about it, though, is that this comment wasn't buried somewhere in the dregs of the replies on social media. It was read out on our public broadcaster as if it was a legitimate contribution to a debate on party politics in Scotland. If this is how low our public discourse and mainstream media have sunk, I truly despair for the future. To draw any sort of comparison between a politician saying he wants to beat an opponent in a free election to the Nazi practice of imprisoning political opponents in concentration camps where they are mistreated, starved and even killed is as absurd as it is insulting to the victims. To invoke the term final solution is so inflammatory that any sensible public broadcaster would surely have considered how this simultaneously belittles the murder of 6 million Jewish people and perpetuates dangerously divisive rhetoric about our politics today. In light of the floods of faux outrage in recent days about the First Minister's remarks, which were made in a speech to party activists in Perth, there is something acutely hypocritical about how readily this sort of rhetoric is accepted when it's targeted at the SNP. We've learned that Tory MSPs and MPs are shocked and appalled by the divisive rhetoric of a political opponent not wanting them to be re-elected, while columnists and commentators worry that it normalises abuse, and broadcasters have dedicated whole segments to examining the implications of the comments. Oddly enough, the same level of alarm over the concept of electoral politics was not expressed when Scottish Labour leader Anna Sawa said in a New Year's message published on Labour List that every corner of the United Kingdom wants to get rid of these morally bankrupt Tories. Or indeed, when he told the Scottish Labour conference last month, the sooner we get rid of this entire shower of Tories, the better. Arguably, the use of adjectives and the official collective noun for Tories makes these remarks more insulting, but I suppose a media storm about whether Scottish Labour is hurting the Tories' feelings just wouldn't be as interesting. At this point, those inconsistencies are not surprising, but they are worth pointing out because they call into question the sincerity and the integrity of any media outlet framing these remarks as somehow controversial when they come from one person's mouth, but not another's. The real double standard, though, lies in the willingness, or lack thereof, to interrogate and challenge genuinely offensive and extreme language, even where it lends itself to your own aims or angle. There has been a normalisation of abuse in politics, but it doesn't come from politicians saying they want to win elections. It comes from the platforming of voices like the one Ms Adams read out on her radio show. Voices who rely on shock value to get attention, but who, if taken seriously, risk inciting hatred and even violence. Recently, there have been a few too many examples of media complicity in cultivating a narrative around Mr Yousaf as extreme in some way or other. Couple this with an almost absolute disinterest in calling out offensive language and accusations made against him, and it becomes clear that much of our media class is ill-equipped to comprehend, never mind communicate, the nuances of racism that still permeate our society. Consider the Telegraph's front page splash earlier this month, which intimated that the First Minister had overruled advice on donating to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine to provide aid in Gaza, with a hidden agenda of securing safe passage out of the region for his wife's family members, sprinkled with undertones about the agency's alleged links to Hamas. Mr. Youssef justifiably called this out as an outrageous smear and far-right conspiracy. Now the BBC is, without challenge, broadcasting irate comments from members of the public who believe Mr. Youssef wants to impose his own version of a final solution onto Scotland. It doesn't take a dog to hear the whistling when a Muslim politician with connections to Palestine is being equated with an ideology which sought to exterminate the Jewish race. Nor should it take a genius to appreciate the risks of amplifying provocative language about a political leader who belongs to a minority currently facing a surge in hate crimes. There's been a lot of talk about the safety of elected representatives and the impacts which the language we use can have on that. It would be shameful for such an important topic to be used only to score political points and disregarded when it's pragmatic to do so. It's depressing to note that the public criticism which has emerged around the comments on Ms. Adams' show has come overwhelmingly, if not entirely, from pro-independence voices. When it comes to the tone of political discussion that we consider acceptable in our country, constitutional and party politics have to be irrelevant, or we have all already lost. A column written by Caitlin Logan. The National News on Wednesday, the 20th of March. 93,000 empty homes worth billions can help ease Scots' housing crisis. An article written by Xander Elliott. There are more than 90,000 abandoned homes in Scotland, and they could be worth more than £18 billion, according to new research. The analysis from commercial and residential lender Together found that there are 10,479 vacant homes in Edinburgh alone, which it estimated were worth around £3.6 billion. A poll further found that more than half of people in Scotland think the number of abandoned buildings in their area is getting worse. A total of 56% of Scots said they see a vacant home every week. The analysis found that the total volume of vacant homes in Scotland has risen by 5.6% in the last 3 years. As of 2023, there were a total of 93,938 residential homes standing empty across Scotland, which Together estimated were worth £18.47 billion. These homes are registered as completely abandoned, with no usual or short-term residence in place, no use as a second home, and no plans for sale or redevelopment. After Edinburgh, Aberdeen was the area with the most vacant homes on 7,863. As part of a UK-wide campaign, Together has partnered with BBC Homes Under the Hammer host Lucy Alexander to champion the redevelopment of these properties. Ms. Alexander said, "Throughout my television career, I've seen my fair share of once-loved, now-neglected properties, some of which can quickly become an eyesore for local residents. It's a real shame, especially as so many people struggle to find affordable housing options and get that first foot onto the property ladder to begin with. Spotting those property hidden gems can really help potential buyers and developers open the doors to a newfound building opportunity, be it for housing, the creation of a new business, or a restorative project. So many existing sites today could see their former glory restored and new purpose given if the right support can be put in place." In December, charities called on the Scottish Government to declare a national housing emergency, claiming that Scotland's homeless system is at breaking point due to a worsening cost of living crisis and a new Home Office policy that puts refugees on the streets. Elliot Viewer, corporate director at Together, said, "There's a clear case for addressing and solving the UK's abandoned and crumbling properties, as our research makes clear. Part of the solution could be turning old and disused buildings into much-needed homes, although this is by no means a magic bullet. However, it should be a matter of civic pride that we don't have these towering eyesores as a feature of our towns and cities. Although many are way past their best, buildings such as these can offer a huge amount of potential for investors and developers with a vision to restore them back to their former glory or repurpose them. There also needs to be greater incentives to encourage home buyers and investors to make the most of the more than 93,000 empty homes across Scotland. Mr. Viewer added, "In both cases, we need a joined-up and pragmatic approach from the property industry and government, allowing us to reap the rewards of wider economic benefits, while preserving our architectural heritage and creating places for people to live." Together's analysis on the number of empty homes in Scotland uses Scottish Government data, as well as figures from local authorities. The expected average prices of the empty properties were estimated using land registry data. Polling was conducted by census-wide research between February the 21st and February the 23rd among 2005 UK adults and is weighted to be nationally representative. An article written by Xander Elliott.
This is from The National on Thursday, 21st March 2024. From the comment section. Here's how to cut Scotland's material consumption levels. By Kim Pratt, Friends of the Earth Scotland Circular Economy Campaigner. In Scotland, the way we use materials is extremely wasteful. When we buy things, from clothes and laptops to toasters and washing machines, they often break easily and are difficult to repair. Many products, especially food and drink containers, are actually designed to be used once and then thrown away. This means everyone buys more and more stuff, which boosts the profits of big businesses, but it's expensive for consumers and a disaster for the planet. The more resources we extract from nature, the more damage we cause to our environment and to the lives of people around the world. The drive to use ever more materials is linked to our growth-obsessed economy. The easiest way for businesses is to increase their profits is to sell more, which means the demand for more materials always rises. But this endless demand for more materials is strangely out of line with the Scottish Government's story about carbon emissions. They claim Scotland's carbon emissions are shrinking, but how can this be if our economy keeps growing, fed by ever-increasing material consumption? The answer is that ministers are choosing to ignore an increasingly large part of our carbon footprint. Only carbon which is emitted in Scotland counts towards Scottish Government's official climate targets. Emissions from imported products are excluded. This climate blind spot now accounts for over half of Scotland's carbon footprint. Scotland's desire for more material is still contributing to the global problem, even if that pollution is recorded in another country's climate stats. This offshoring trend is seen across many of the key materials we use in our economy, not just the ones we buy as consumers. Steel, which is essential for infrastructure projects from bridges to buildings and wind turbines, is a clear example of this. When the Ravenscraig steel mill closed in 1992, it wiped 3.5 million tonnes of carbon off Scotland's carbon balance sheets. But Scotland's demand for steel didn't stop. In fact, it has grown. Today, we import all the steel we need, with much less control over the production process. The good news is that there is a way to fix this blind spot. The Scottish Government can create a new target in line with our existing climate commitments that will reduce the impact of our consumption. This week, the Scottish Parliament will have an opportunity to support fairer and more sustainable material use when it votes on a new circular economy law. Our current approach to materials is described as the linear economy, where we take resources from nature, use them briefly, and then dispose of them, usually in landfill or incinerator. The target would drive the Scottish Government to introduce policies to minimise material use and ensure the products we buy will last longer. By encouraging more reuse and repair, we can learn new skills and help people who will save money on the things they buy. Businesses which put unsustainable and non-recyclable products on our shelves should be made to take responsibility for cleaning them up when they're littered on our streets and dumped in our oceans. Currently, greedy businesses can keep passing the costs of cleaning up their mess onto the public purse. A circular economy creates new job opportunities too. Building one steel recycling plant in Scotland could create 650 jobs and add £400 million to the Scottish economy. But this won't happen without the support from government to give people the security and skills they need to make these changes. The new circular economy law must recognise this. Creating a world with less stuff can bring benefits for everyone. It means the things we buy are better made and are easier to fix, as well as cutting carbon emissions and creating jobs. But we must act now, before the whole world turns into one big rubbish dump. Ignoring how much our imports damage the planet doesn't stop it happening. Scotland's new circular economy law is the first step towards a fairer and more sustainable future, but this will only happen if it is honest about all the impacts of our consumption, including imports. That article was by Kim Pratt, Friends of the Earth, Scotland Circular Economy Campaigner. This is from The National on Thursday, 21st March 2024, from the Culture section. Travis, Scottish band release new single ahead of tour with Killers. By Adam Robertson. Scottish band Travis have released a new single ahead of the release of their 10th studio album later this year. The Scottish Rockers, led by Fran Healy, will release LA Times on July 12th this year and released their latest single, Gaslight, on Thursday. The latest album will arrive 25 years after the band released their breakthrough number one album, The Man Who. Travis are set to begin a huge live season this summer, performing with The Killers across their 16-date UK arena tour through June and July. Speaking about the new single, Gaslight, Healy said, "I read a few weeks ago that gaslighting was the most web-searched word in the world. We are living in a time where our realities are being warped by bosses, leaders, friends, teachers and politicians. It really is everywhere. Gaslighters want to control you. They tell you things which undermine your confidence in yourself and make you question reality, and it makes you feel like you're going crazy." Travis were first formed in the Glasgow School of Art in the 1990s and are best known for their much-loved records The Man Who, The Invisible Band, and The Boy With No Name. That article was by Adam Robertson.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.